And welcome back in. Final hour of Robbie and Rex Road here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley, Joe Rex Road, Ryan Porth here with you on this Tuesday morning in Nashville, Tennessee. And it's that time of the week. We go to our 102.5 The Game phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, and bring in our man Charles Robinson from Yahoo Sports. Charles, what's going on, man? How you doing?
I'm doing well, fellas. How you guys doing today?
We are doing very well as well, Charles. Thanks for asking. And Titans fans, however, not doing so well right now after the loss to the Ravens on Sunday. Their season is now over. What did you think of the Ravens and their ability to shut down Derrick Henry and the Titans offense in that game? And do you view the Ravens any differently now after that game that they were able to get it done here in Nashville?
Well, they learned. I mean, there's no doubt that the Ravens learned. You know, there was Henry was the priority there. I don't think there was any question about that. And they sold out to make sure that, you know, it's going to be Tannehill who's going to have to beat them. And, you know, the game turned – look, the Peters interception, it's unfortunate to see somebody trip, you know, some feet get tangled on that play. I know there was a little bit of contact up top, but I was a little surprised Tannehill put the ball up. You know, it was a decision he made. Probably would have been a tough play either way. It came down to – Baltimore essentially sitting here and saying, look, we know this entire offense is going to be predicated on what Derrick Henry can do to us. I think they took it personally. I think the Ravens took it personally, given really the last year of looking at this team, facing this team, and clearly they were pretty emotional about the disrespect, you know, in their minds, they felt like the Titans had for the organization. I know that was something that, you know, I had a chance to talk to somebody this week, and you might as well have played of the events of the last, you know, season on a loop and in the Ravens facility leading up to that game. And that does matter in the playoffs. I will say that in the postseason, it's gone into many a locker room and found people who have manufactured all the juice they need. And Mike Vrabel came out of an organization in New England where they did that nonstop. I mean, I would go in there for years and years when they were clearly considered the dynastic organization of the NFL. And yet they always felt like somebody was disrespecting them or, you know, not giving them the credit that they deserve. So it's unfortunate for the Titans for things to end like this, but I also think it's a game that showcased a lot of the flaws that began last offseason, the things that we all talked about on this show repeatedly over the course of the season. I think a lot of that showed up in this game, and I think it's worthwhile talking about this whole defensive coordinator thing and how Mike is handling it and the way he's commented on it, and this whole, you know, well, now Shane Bowen was the defensive coordinator the entire season, you know, led the meetings, called the plays. That is a thing, and it's interesting because it seems to be a thing that hovers around a lot of guys that come out of New England. And I think that's something they learned from Bill, and you see people leave New England and have a penchant for holding off on naming coordinator positions in which they want to be involved in that side of the ball. I've seen it happen with Bill O'Brien. It's happened with, you know, when Brian Flores was in New England and he didn't get that defensive coordinator tag, and then he ends up, you know, ascending to being the head coach of the offense of the Miami Dolphins without ever having the DC tag in New England. You have conversations with guys about why that occurs, and when you talk to players, I do think that does matter.
Well, yeah, I mean, Vrabel yesterday made it sound like, you know, like this is all immediate creation. Like, oh, yeah, you guys just make a big deal out of title. And I mean, the question that I should have asked next was then, you know, okay, so why even bother then? Why isn't Arthur Smith just the tight ends coach who calls plays? Right. I mean, it seems to matter to some extent, right? I mean, why don't we just say everybody's just a coach and we just walk around and sing kumbaya, and we'll all just coach each other's players every other day and see what happens. It's just bizarre to me. But do you think, Charles, do you think that Mike, because he's been very much his guys, quote-unquote, even though, you know, obviously it doesn't have a huge history of coaching, but it's been in the circle for the most part. Do you think it would be good for him to go outside that?
I think that can be beneficial, but I will say this, it is difficult, you know, to go outside the circle because it really is all about trust. And a reason why, when people say, well, why don't these guys name coordinators? So when Brian Flores didn't get that DC tag, there were a lot of people internally, his last year in New England, there were a lot of people who were upset because they felt like he earned it. They're like, well, you know, Matt Patricia eventually got it. You know, why wouldn't, you know, Brian Flores get it? So I asked the question, like, why do these guys come out of New England and they don't give these tags out? And someone in the system told me, like, it's because you have head coaches who learn a lot about control, a lot about wanting to have the ability to control situations and insert themselves when they feel like they want to do that. And if they don't have complete and total trust in someone to run the system as they see it fit, they want the ability to step in at times. And the easiest way to do that is you're not stepping on toes if you don't name a DC. So when Flores had his last year in New England, if Bill wanted to dip in on the scheme from week to week and say, okay, hey, you know, I think we should do this, I think we should do that, if he wanted to lead a meeting that he felt was particularly important or whatever, well, Flores didn't have the DC title. And you know, so that Bill was the de facto DC. Everybody knew that. Like, they knew Flo was calling it. They knew Flo was the guy. But at the same time, he didn't have that title, and players knew what that meant. I think there was a little bit of that with Mike. And so I don't know if there just wasn't the total trust in Shane, or he wanted the – again, it's about control, wanted the ability to control it if he felt like it was necessary. Maybe he thought he saw some of the holes as the season approached and, you know, just thought, hey, I'm not going to give it to him in the summer. Like, I want to retain things the way they are so that I can impress myself upon it. Now, you know, going out and getting someone who is not necessarily in your circle of trust can work. I look at the Rams. Like, they went out and got Brandon Staley. And I remember when Sean McVay, I would go in the Rams organization, there was a lot of talk about Wade Phillips. And, you know, Sean didn't think he was as cutting edge as he needed to be at times. And, you know, he wanted a guy who could run a lot of different multiple looks, disguises, all these different things. So he goes out and he gets Brandon Staley. It was a dice roll. Like, people are like, look, you know, Sean had done his due diligence. He, you know, he felt like this was going to be the right call, but it was definitely a dice roll. And you see times where guys get brought into the fold and it just doesn't work out, you know, particularly OCs like John DeFilippo, when he left, you know, Philadelphia and kind of bounced around in Minnesota, ends up in Jacksonville. You know, that was a guy that was brought in at times, and right away you had staffs who were like, yeah, we're not on the same page. Mike Zimmer was never on the same page with him in Minnesota when it came to, like, running the football. So that's the gamble you take, is that you bring in someone, you give them that power, you don't want to step on their toes in front of people and insert yourselves. You can't now because you really gave them that coordinator role, and then they don't necessarily run things exactly the way you feel like it needs to be done. And that creates a whole other, you know, schism inside an organization. So I think there's probably some of that there. But I would just say to fans who listen now, it's not a media creation. It does matter. I asked Deshaun Watson once about Bill O'Brien running the offense there. And Watson said something, I think this is really interesting now. It's a quarterback's different, but I do think it matters. He said, look, when you got an OC, anytime I need something, that guy's always available to me, always. I'm always going to him. I'm like, hey, let's do this, let's do that, let's have these conversations. He said, when the OC is also the head coach at the same time, he's got other responsibilities. I can't get him all the time. It's not always going to be something that I can reach out to this person. And that, you know, does become important at certain elements of the season to a player. So, I don't know. But you tell me. I mean, like, maybe, I guess, in Mike's mind, he's got the state of the art thinking on this, and he knows the temperature of all those players, and this was all a media problem, and everything that happened defensively, apparently Joe Rexroth caused it.
I mean, you know, I could have gotten it, like, no sacks.
Like, you should have signed a better pass rusher, Joe. Like, what happened?
Yeah, do a better job, Rexroth. Charles Robinson from Yahoo Sports on the line with us, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. Charles, let's talk about Arthur Smith, because we had this debate last week on the show about what the best landing spot for him would be, and the Chargers got thrown out there, the Jags, the Texans, and obviously this was before the Philadelphia job even came open at that point. What do you think would be the best landing spot for Arthur Smith, and did the game on Sunday and how inept the Titans offense looked, did that hurt him in any way in terms of discussions with NFL teams becoming a head coach?
Well, you hope teams aren't the prisoner of the moment, right? I mean, you hope teams aren't. I would say this: good organizations don't sit there and go, "Well, the last impression we're left with is the overriding, you know, impression." So, I would say that, you know, you look at the development of the wideouts, you know, with the Tennessee Titans. You look at the balance in the offense, the fact that you have a 2,000-yard runner, the development of Ryan Tannehill. I think overall teams have to take that into account and go, well, you know what, a bad last game. Let's not let that be what ultimately undoes how we think about him. If you ask me what's the best situation, I still think now Shad Khan's throwing a wrench in this. I still think that Jacksonville, I would tend to want to go in knowing that I'm walking in the door with a general manager. I'm walking in the door with my quarterback, you know, with the quarterback that we're taking who's going to learn from me. The having all three of those, you know, really cornerstones of the organization all coming in year one, I think can be really beneficial because it eliminates some awkwardness down the line. Now, that said, Shad Khan said, I'm keeping the roster control. If I'm a head coach, that's a problem. And I've talked to a couple candidates that are on the coaching circuit. And the day Shad Khan said that about the Jacksonville Jaguars, it shook him up. Like, it's just, okay, well, he's telling general managers they're coming in and interviewing that he's keeping the 53 right now, and we'll see. And he's telling head coaches, I'm keeping the 53, we'll see. Massive red flag. So to me, Jacksonville, that moved Jacksonville out of that top slot because you just don't – you're going to have an owner now who's gonna dictate the talent because of bad experience he had with Tom Coughlin. So if I'm Arthur Smith, you know, have to think about that and know really what is this guy going to end up doing with the 53-man roster if this is offered to me. So, I think the Chargers to me are probably the best destination just given the talent there, the quarterback that's there to work with, the ability for Arthur Smith to walk in and run the kind of balance, you know, scheme he can run in Tennessee. But I also think some of this is being dictated by, you know, what's going to happen with Brian Daboll. I think, weirdly enough, Doug Peterson, you know, the separation in Philadelphia could actually impact this because I really do think Doug Peterson could be a candidate in New York with the Jets. I think they could look at him. So this has been an interesting coaching search. I feel like it's been elongated a little bit by these Zoom interviews. And the tells that are usually obvious are not as obvious now. Now we're seeing guys get flown in a second time in some places. But the previous tells of, hey, so-and-so goes in, supposed to be a 1 or 2 day thing. Now it's extended. He's still in the building. All of a sudden, you know, okay, you're understanding what's going on with the flow of sort of that interview process. Over Zoom, good luck. Like, it's been a completely different experience, like most things have been all season long. You have a lot of people who aren't necessarily as intimately involved or knowing precisely what's going on with candidates now. So I would say it's more important now than ever that general managers and owners know what they're doing when they're making head coaching hires. And historically, particularly when it comes to owners, I don't know if they ever really know what they're doing.
Brian Daboll, huh? According to Twitter, you think he sucks. So. glad you brought him
thanks,
up again.
Joe.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, no problem. I love taking your quotes out of context.
Yeah. Joe throws hand grenades into like the worst like fan base. I get like murdered by Bills fans. I'm like, I don't know anything you do with this. Like listen to the whole interview. This is my fault. Thanks, Joe.
Yeah, I gotta figure some way to like get Steelers fans mad at you or something. I'm trying to think of who could really be fun.
Mike Vrabel's right. This is Joe's creating stuff out
there's
here.
A lot. Yeah,
you gotta watch it, man. You gotta watch me. So let's go to fans in your town, Charles. Are they going to be? Is there any chance they're going to be watching a different quarterback in the future than the one who currently quarterbacks their professional football team?
I mean, who's going to give up a Herschel Walker trade for, you know, Deshaun Watson? Because there's no way ownership or Nick Caserio, I don't think that anyone's going to let Watson out the door for, you know, I mean, it's going to have to be three firsts, three, I mean, it would have to just be an unbelievable bounty, you know, to get him out the door. Now, I will say this about Nick Caserio. Comes in from a New England system where they know the benefits of not carrying around the massive quarterback contract. Deshaun Watson's got that. There's no, you know, getting away from that. Now, could they extricate themselves from that and, you know, with less pain than you would think? Yes, you know, they could. But I also don't think Casario's first order of business is going to be walk in and, you know, take a player who, you know, clearly an immense talent, let him go out the door, and then all of a sudden insert yourself into the quarterback question and then potentially watch Watson go somewhere else and blow it up the way, like, say, you know, Jalen Ramsey has. Look, Jalen Ramsey is a great player in Jacksonville. He goes to the Rams, and he's been a, you know, really significant linchpin on making that defense the number one, you know, defense that it is. So I don't think Caserio wants to do that. I don't know who would – there's a lot of quarterbacks out there now, so I don't know who would sit there and go, okay, we're just going to give up everything. I do see a lot of, like, dream, ridiculous scenarios out there where people are like, well, hey, maybe it's this guy, or maybe the Broncos can give up Drew Lock in a first. And I'm like, okay, really? Like,
yay!
Like, this is, yeah, I'm like, I don't know. This is fantasy football, okay? Like, this is so it's I will say this: like, what's going on with Watson? This is bad. It's all bad. You don't. It is not good to have a guy who has now consistently, I think, kind of let his displeasure get out there. Now, this isn't new. This has been going on, and it's been a little more subtle before this. And he has an agent, David Mulugeta, who, you know, again, go back and look at what happened with Jalen Ramsey. Like, he was able to get Jalen Ramsey off of a team that absolutely did not want to give him up. Particularly the owner did not want to give up Jalen Ramsey. And I think that's part of why the owner now has taken the 53 into his searches. And so, you know, but he found a way to get the Rams to offer enough that changed the minds of ownership in Jacksonville, combined with the fact that Ramsey wouldn't get on the field for them. So I don't know. Like, if Watson's willing to go, you know what, I'm just not going to play. Forget it. Like, I'm not going to be in the org. I'm not going to show up during any of the offseason stuff. I'm not showing up for preseason. I'm not playing. I'm going to do the Carson Palmer and say, I'll retire to get out of this organization. Then maybe. But no way the Texans, you know, walk from that kid without just a monumental, astronomical trade. And if they did, it would subvert Nick Caserio from his first offseason on. No one would ever forget this.
Charles Robinson from Yahoo Sports on the line with us, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. And Charles, another matchup between the Saints and the Bucs coming up this weekend. Do you think the third time could be the charm for Tom Brady and company in this matchup? How do you see that game going?
I should know this, but I struggle to remember the last time Tom lost to a team three times in a year. And I do think that matters. I think he is a guy that can figure out, you know, what the mistakes he's made in previous stops. And I mean, this is like the old hit the old guy game. Like, I think to me, it's going to boil down to a pretty simplistic view. And because you're not going to throw disguises at these guys, that they're not going to understand things. You're not going to show them defensive looks. They don't, like, you can just take the typical, you know, kind of bullet points of what defenses go through over the course of a week, and whatever you throw at these guys, it's not going to matter. They're going to know what you're doing. It's just, can you hit them or not? Period. Like, which team is going to be able to affect the other guy? Because neither of those guys likes to get hit. You know, you talk to pro personnel guys and, you know, people who do advances on teams, things like that, and they'll tell you the same thing about Brees and Brady. You hit them and their accuracy significantly diminishes, and you'll see them, you know, their eyes are they get a little wonky in the way that they're looking at things, or they're locking at guys, or they're sailing balls. And I think that's something that's become a little more prevalent, you know, in the advanced years. Tom's never liked to get hit. He's always kind of been that guy. And Drew is far more banged up this year than he's ever been in his career. And so I think it's just going to come down to which one of these guys gets hit more. And I think that will really affect the way that this game ends up unfolding. I'll say this about Tampa Bay's offensive line. Like, they've Tristan Wirfs, good Lord. Like, that kid really lived up to, I mean, I remember when he was just, you know, we're at the combine and he's working, you know, it's always this workout freak, and guys are like, everybody's getting way over their heads on him. He's, you know, he's a good player, but, you know, he's going to be a guard, and he's, you know, don't get overly locked in on the workout stuff. I don't know, man. It's translated pretty well. He's been fantastic for them. So their offensive line's really come together. So I look forward to seeing which one of these guys wants to end up going to Green Bay to finish out. I'm confident that the Packers are going to find their way into the NFC title game, and I cannot imagine you know, Tampa Tom in the warmth of now I know, look, listen, I understand he played in New England. I moved to Texas. It took me 3 minutes to acclimate to the environment in Texas. And I don't know which dome, you know, Drew and Tampa Tom going into Lambeau in late January is just a disgusting thought for, you know, someone of that age. Look, I'm 43 and I'm like, I can barely get out of bed like every morning. I don't know how any of these guys is playing like they're a 20-year-old quarterback at the state.
Well, I last thing, Charles, and I mean, I hate to bring it back to Jacksonville, but I got to ask you on athletic non-subscriber copy and paster Urban Meyer. Is he going to be the Jacksonville Jaguars' next coach?
I don't know. Like, I can't. I will be completely honest with you. He is the most frustrating person on the earth. Like, when it comes to coaching searches, like, he is just the most in and out. Is he really involved? Like, I went through the Urban thing last offseason, okay, with Dallas. Oh, is he, you know, it always felt like Urban wanted that job, and that's how all this stuff got out there about, is Urban Meyer a Dallas Cowboys candidate? He was never a Dallas Cowboys candidate. He'd never get a Dallas Cowboys job. Then all of a sudden he pops up in the Washington search. Oh, is he, you know, Urban's, you know, there are people around Urban that are saying that, you know, he wants Washington, Washington's interested. No, that was never. And so I'm like, what's real, what's not? And I do think Jacksonville is legitimately interested, but the problem I always have is that Urban has one foot in, one foot out, and it's all the way to the end of the search. And, you know, if he wants that job, Jacksonville will hire him. I will say that. But I think that I don't know whether Urban likes the idea of actually having a coaching job, or he likes the idea of being a coaching candidate that teams really actually want more. Like, which one of those is it more? So, I don't know. Again, I am soft on guys that are, you know, do I want this or don't I want this coaching candidates? Like, I don't, if he wants that Jacksonville job, he should be racing to it like it's the Indy 500. I mean, he should want that job and, you know, be ready to build a program, particularly if they want him, regardless of the 53, because if they're pursuing him, I think he can finesse that to make sure that 53 ends up where it needs to be.
Charles Robinson from Yahoo Sports has been our guest here on Robbie and Rexro. Charles, great stuff as always, man, and we'll see how Rexro can get your own trouble this week after the segment's
thanks,
over.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Yeah, I appreciate this. Let me know who you're going to upset so I can start working my way out of that situation now.
Urban's camp will be all over you by the afternoon.
That's right.
Okay. All right.
Thanks, Charles. Great. All right. Appreciate it, man.
Take care, man.
Oh, great stuff there as always from Charles Robinson. It's interesting, like, going back to the Titans and Shane Bowen. And we talked about it earlier in the show, Joe. The way that Vrabel handled that yesterday with the comments, basically saying, you know, Shane Bowen, he's acted as a defensive coordinator all year. Just didn't have the title. He led the meetings. He called the plays. Pretty much everything that you want a defensive coordinator to do, Shane Bowen was doing. It just wasn't a title. And, you know, I guess I apologize stuff from Mike Vrabel and how it took on a life of its own. But it was interesting to get Charles and his vantage point there because, again, if it doesn't matter, then why does anybody have a title? It's just I think the more the time and distance that gets away from this season, the more ridiculous I think it'll be in the way that Vrabel handled the DC situation this year with the Titans.
Yeah, see, and I hear what Charles is saying about, you know, control. I guess it's easier if no one has the title that you can just be like, okay, we're doing this. But I guess to me, if you're the head coach, why can't you do that anyway? Like, even with Belichick, I think I'd never really thought about it in those terms. like other, like if the, someone has, like he tiptoed around Patricia because he had the title. I mean, that just kind of, that seems a little strange to me. I've looked at it more like, let's not put the weight of the world on Shane's shoulders yet, like kind of a tryout year sort of thing. I mean, it seems more like that than what Charles was talking about there. But regardless, it didn't work. I mean, it didn't work. And it's got to be fixed. And I don't see how this defense, the number one thing is personnel. I believe that 100 times out of 100 more. The biggest problem was they didn't have players who could make an impact, especially up front, to help you be a good defensive football team. But there's got to be a different look to the defensive coaching staff next year, including someone with the title that apparently means nothing.
So, Joe, speaking of titles that apparently mean nothing, offensive coordinator Arthur Smith, obviously very heavily involved in the coaching searches going on across the NFL. Now one more job open, and also potentially one more head coaching candidate out there in Doug Peterson. Does that factor in at all to Arthur Smith? And also, like, does the game that just happened against Baltimore, does that affect his coaching candidacy one way or the other, in your opinion, in this search?
Well, and the second thing, I agree with Charles. I mean, if you're going to go on that, then you're screwed when you're hired a coach. You're going to make a bad hire. I mean, that's, yeah, it's one day, and the large stack of evidence shows you what Arthur Smith is as an OC. Plus, you know, one bad day of calling plays. I mean, head coach is about more than that anyway. So it's going to be much more about his interviews and references and all these things. I think he's going to get probably more than one offer here. Question is, will he get the right one? I mean, if all he gets is the Lions offer, I would advise him to come back to the Titans and give it another run. But this is a highly attractive compared to most years and the job cycle of the NFL. I cannot remember more jobs with attractive quarterback situations than this. Usually it's, I mean, I know in some cases it's because you're going to draft one. But still, how are you not excited about the idea of coaching Trevor Lawrence in Jacksonville, for example? And then we'll see what the Jets are going to do. And then a lot of these places have good quarterbacks in place. So I just can't imagine he won't end up with something. But Doug Peterson, yeah, he's the one guy who gets fired who you think, okay, he might bounce right back somewhere and take one of these jobs himself. So, I mean, it's basically to me like Lions. I hear what Charles is saying on ownership with the Jags, and also I think you worry about ownership with the Texans, you know. But other than the Lions and the Jets, I think everything else looks awfully attractive.
When we come back, we're going to switch gears and dive into the Nashville Predators. Preds TV analyst and former goaltender Chris Mason will join us, so looking forward to that conversation with him. That's coming up next. You're listening to Robbie and Rex Road here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back in, Robbie and Rex Road here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley, Joe Rex Road, Ryan Porth here with you on this Tuesday morning in Nashville, Tennessee. Just a couple of days away from dropping the puck for real on the 2021 Nashville Predator season. And to help us talk more about that, we go to our 102.5 The Game phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, and bring in Preds TV analyst, former Preds goalie, Chris Mason, brought to you by Coleman Tractor, Tennessee's largest Kubota dealer. See, Mace, what's going on, brother? How we doing?
What's up, guys? Doing great. Just getting ready to
get things going here, and we're looking forward to it in a couple of days, the puck dropping against Columbus. So, C-Mace, as you look at this Preds team, you look at the group and the roster they've got coming in this year, what do you want to see right from the jump with this group in terms of the way that they're playing and the style of play that they bring to the table? I think we may have lost C-Mace. We'll attempt to reconnect there with Chris Mason, because we would love to get his perspective as a former goaltender. Lots to get to in the condensed schedule this year as well. But, Joe, that is going to be interesting. Like, how does the team handle this right from the jump in a season where you really don't have time to mess around? 56 games, you don't have the luxury of going 2.5 weeks and trying to figure out your game with the schedule being what it is.
I know C-Mace isn't on Zoom, but I want him with me in the smashing of the of the equipment too. He would be an awesome cohort for that. Yeah, I mean, it's it's a different kind of. I mean, really, it changes what I think would have been the natural progression from Saros to Rene this year. Kind of a, you know, like last year was the transitional year, but this year in a normal season would have been, to me, that where you see it flip-flopped, where you see Pecorine is the clear two and he gets about 30 games and UC Saros gets about 50 games and you're spread out and probably works out well. You know, it's more demanding, obviously, when you talk about this condensed schedule and all the back-to-backs. And so the teams that have two goalies they feel good about, I would say just naturally have the advantage, and that's obviously not every team.
Yeah, and to that point, we've got Chris Mason back on the line with us. And C-Mace, just right from the jump, what do you want to see from this group in terms of the style of play? And how do you think the schedule will dictate what we see from Saros and Rene in terms of the deployment of how they're used?
I think Joe makes a great point. This year is obviously going to be completely different. It would have been if it was a full season. You might have seen more of an opportunity to kind of hand the keys over to Juice in terms of the bulk of the playing work and maybe the future of the starting goaltender here in Nashville. But given the circumstances, I feel, you know, depending, their play is going to dictate it a lot more. So it's going to be one of those things. It always does, but I think even more so now because it's so condensed. You're playing, you know, 17 or 8 teams 7 times, and it's only 56 games. So I think, you know, if a guy's playing well right now and he's going to let him go with it, but they're going to have, no matter what, they're going to have all these back-to-backs. They're going to have to flip-flop and manage those types of situations too. So going to be very interesting. But, you know, again, it gives Pekka a chance. Like after the first scrimmage, I thought, all right, well, Pekka's going to get the start. And then as the second scrimmage, I'm like, well, I think Juice will be starting Thursday. But I think we'll be seeing a lot of that flip-flop back and forth. And as for the identity of this team, I think we've all heard, you know, what the players have said and what John Hines has said right from when he got here, really. Of what he wants the identity of this team to be, which is, you know, extremely hard to play against, attention to detail, and playing the right way. And I think, you know, grit too is a big word that you know, David Poile used and John Hines used in the offseason of what kind of players they wanted to bring in to try to kind of get back to playing the way I think we remember the Predators from years back. That was that kind of a feisty, gritty, just relentlessly working, hard-working team. We never, you know, not necessarily always had the talent that this group has, but if they can really embody that and really embrace that identity as a team with the talent they have, I think it's exactly what I feel like they missed maybe the last couple of years is that grit, is that every single night, you know, it seems sometimes they came out and they played really hard and you're like, all right, there it is. That's what we want. That's the way we, you know, that's the way they got to that. We always talk about 2017, but that's the way they played in 2017. It looks like that team again. We've always been waiting for that kind of feeling again. And I think they want to get back to that. And so far, the guys that they brought in, I've been really impressed with them at camp and during the scrimmages as well.
Preds TV analyst Chris Mason on the line with us, brought to you by Coleman Tractor, Tennessee's largest Kubota dealer. And C-Mace, that Johansson line, I mean, we had Forsberg on a couple of weeks ago, and he talked about it. Nobody on that line had the season that we have come to expect from them last season. So as you look ahead to this year, assuming that they leave Forsberg, Johansson, and Arvidsson together, what would be your expectation and your confidence that they have a bounce-back year together this year on that line?
My confidence in that line, barring health, is for the bounce-back extremely high. These are guys, you know, and I think, too, and again, you know, John Hines, I thought, did a really good job when he came in, and he changed the mindset, you know, about the ice time and it's not given, it's earned. And if you don't play the right way, and he talked to Philip about changing his focus to playing the right way. Don't worry about the points. I know you look at the stat sheet every day and the points aren't where they want to be. But if you play the right way, I'm telling you, they're going to come. And I think this year, these guys, if they can stay healthy, I think they can, you know, they have that chemistry and they have the ability, you know, to be a force, to be one of those top lines in the National Hockey League. So I really feel strongly about a bounce back for that team, and it's just a complete change in mindset, I think, for them.
Chris, Ellie Tolvanen is 21 years old, which is kind of amazing, you know, because of how long we've been talking about him, and certain media members who will go unnamed may have hyped him a bit a few years ago. But I've heard some talk around Tolvanen, like, oh, here's like, you know, this is your chance to prove it, you know. And I wonder, like, do you think that's fair? I mean, we see some guys take till 23, 24 or whatever to find themselves. I mean, do you think this is that kind of situation for Tolvanen right now?
I mean, I don't think so. I think, like you said, I feel like everyone feels like he's much older and he's been around a lot longer than he has, just because of when we started hearing his name. And, you know, you see all the highlights and you expect the kid. Everyone develops at different times. You know, some kids can come in right away and they can, you know, be effective as a 19, 20-year-old. And other kids, they don't figure it out, or they don't, you know, exactly find their way until they're, you know, 25 years old, a little more maturity and confidence and just learning how to process the game in the NHL level, you know, at the level it needs to be in all areas. And I think he's one of those guys. He definitely, you know, he leaves you wanting more, I feel like, when he got called up. You're like, oh, okay, where is it? And then you go down to Milwaukee, you see the highlights, and you're like, okay, that's what we need. You expect to see that when he comes up. And I feel sometimes it takes time for some players. And I think he's one of those guys. He did the right thing, I think, by committing to play in Milwaukee. I know Scott Nichols said he could have went back to Russia and he could have made, you know, a boatload of money, but he wanted to come and learn, you know, to play, you know, quote unquote, the right way and play defense and on the other side of the puck and get the details in his game stronger. And, you know, I think he'll get there. I don't think it's, I would never, I've seen too many people write people off too early. I don't know what the point of doing that is, because you honestly, nobody ever knows. You never know how somebody's going to turn out, if it's this year or 2 years and it finally clicks. So I think every player is unique in their development, and he's one of those guys that I see progress. That's what I'm looking for. I want to see progress. Once the progress stops, then maybe you can say, all right, you know, that's as good as it's going to get. But I see, every time I see him, I see a little more progress. I don't know if he's quite ready yet, to be honest with you, in my opinion. But I have seen progress in his game, so that's a good thing to me.
See, Mace, nobody expects a third defense pairing to go out there and win you a game or anything like that, but I have thought the last few years that the third pair has been a pretty heavy point of weakness for this Predators team. And I don't know about you, but I look at this new third pair with Borowiecki and Benning coming in, and I think I feel as good about this six on defense as I have in a long time for the Predators. Is that fair? Would you agree with that statement heading into this season, that this might be the best six that they've had on defense in the last few years?
I would say so. And then you throw, you know, Tenorti in the mix. And I think when you get a third pair out there, I think a lot of times, you know, you could, other teams might be able to exploit them, you know, when the Preds are the road team and the home team gets last change. I think that's, you know, can happen quite often. And I think, you know, the dynamic this year, Benning's a solid player, plays physical. Borowiecki, obviously, the guy's a beast. I think when other teams' top lines are out against those guys, or if Tenorti's in there, there's a little bit of fear factor. You play a different way. You're not so, you know, gung-ho to get in there in the forecheck and bang it up with, you know, with Borowiecki in the corner, because you know you're going to have to pay the price, right? You're going to have to, there's a price to be paid if you want to get that puck or if you want to go to the front of the net. And that does a lot mentally. You know, when you're lining up against that third pair now, and it's a veteran presence, that type of thing, he's, you know, when he's out there. And I think, you know, the last couple of years, there's, you know, they've had some decent moments, but I don't think it's been, you know, a situation where maybe the most confidence is they've had in that group as the third pair. And I think now, I think, you know, with the depth that they have too, and the taxi squad, and, you know, possibly Yannick Weber or Carrier or Davies or whoever, you know, ends up on that taxi squad, they're going to have some good options to maybe, you know, change that up if they need to. But I think Benning, Borowiecki, that's, to me, on paper, that seems like really good. And when you look at what they've done in their careers, that's a really solid third pair.
So, Chris, after the first few games, which new face on this team are we all going to be talking about?
Man, I'll tell you what, I know it's the scrimmages, but were you guys at the scrimmages? I can't remember if I saw anyone else there, but I think Nick Cousins, I think this guy, I hope Cunningham, because that second line might take a little bit to get going, just because they got back late and, you know, they got to find chemistry and find a way to make things happen, and it doesn't happen overnight. But I think Nick Cousins, the way he plays, and John Hines, told Crispy and us that he's got that sneaky skill. Like, he's a good player, but he's also, like, he's a little rat, like, agitator. He's in your face. He was hitting guys, you know, all over the ice, and he just gets in there all the time. So I'm looking at him just because he's one of those guys that you notice all the time. He makes things happen. He gets in your face. He gets the other team off their game. So I'll throw him out there for now. But I'm hoping Eric Halla, too. You know, we only saw him one time, and he just got over here, too, so it might take him a while to get going. But you never know. And he's a guy that another guy looking for a bounce back. I think we have a lot of those stories on the team this year.
Preds TV analyst Chris Mason has been our guest here on Robbie and Rex Road, brought to you by Coleman Tractor, Tennessee's largest Kubota dealer. C. Mace, great stuff, man. Appreciate you taking time to join us, and looking forward to getting things kicked off on Thursday.
Yeah, let's do this. Thanks, guys.
Absolutely. Chris Mason,
thanks, buddy.
One of the best in the business. When we come back, I've got an interesting question I want to throw out there. Is Roman Josi well on his way to becoming the best player in team history, even ahead of Pekka Rinne? We'll discuss that on the other side. This is Robbie and Rex Road here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Preds fans, Smashville Live returns tomorrow night on 102.5 The Game. Tomorrow's guests will be Preds players Nick Cousins and Luke Cunning, so two newcomers on the show tomorrow. And the show will air every Wednesday during the Preds season from 6 to 7 p.m. and will feature Preds players, former players, and other special guests. And something new this year, we're going virtual, so you can watch the show from the comforts of your own home via 102.5 The Game's Twitch, Facebook page, YouTube, and more. So be sure to join us every Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m. this hockey season for Smashville Live, brought to you by New Amsterdam Vodka and Red Spirits and Wine in Bellevue. Welcome back in, Robbie and Rex Road here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley, Joe Rex Road, Ryan Porth here with you on this Tuesday morning. Going to continue the Preds talk here in just a few minutes. But, Joe, some breaking news right now on the basketball front. Vanderbilt and their game against Tennessee tonight has officially been postponed due to a combination of positive test, contact tracing, and subsequent quarantining of individuals within the Vanderbilt basketball program. So that coming out just a few minutes ago from Vanderbilt, they announced that. And it just continues to be tough to navigate through this SEC basketball schedule with COVID and all the different protocols in place. And it struck yet again between Vanderbilt and Tennessee.
You know, Missouri and South Carolina, they were both supposed to play those two programs tonight. Those two programs had issues, so they said, okay, let's double up this week. And Tennessee actually was here last night. Yep. So they are now heading back to Knoxville. And as of now, the Saturday game in Knoxville between Vanderbilt and Tennessee is on. But, I mean, you know, certainly based on the usual timeline here, yep, I wouldn't be surprised at all if that doesn't happen. I wonder if there's any way Tennessee could get a different game for Saturday. It's short, you know, planning, but that's what they did here. So stay tuned on that.
Stay tuned. Indeed. We knew it was going to be difficult and interesting to navigate through this season. And it certainly has been that way so far in college basketball. So we'll continue to keep you updated on that. We had Chris Mason on, Joe, in the last segment talking about the Predators, their season getting underway on Thursday against Columbus. And you look back, Roman Josi obviously was just outstanding a year ago. He won the Norris Trophy, the best season he's ever had by far, 65 points in 69 games, was dynamic offensively, was consistent night in and night out. And it got me thinking, like, if you start talking about the Nashville Predators and the history of their franchise and the players that have been the most important or the best players that they've ever had, Pekka Rinne is at the top of that list for nearly everybody when you begin to list those off. I mean, there are other people in the conversation, obviously Shea Weber, you know, Mike Fisher and the leadership that he brought here, Paul Kariya in the 2 years that he had, how outstanding he was during that time. But it got me thinking, like, Roman Josi, where he is right now, I think you can make an argument he's already the best defenseman in franchise history. It'd probably be between him and Shea Weber on that front. But how close do you think he is to becoming officially the best player the Predators have ever had? And when you start talking about the face of the franchise, Roman Josi is the first name that comes to mind.
That's a great question. I don't know that he's, like, right on the verge here. I mean, you know, it wasn't that long ago that Pekka Rinne won the Vezina. Wasn't that long ago he led this team to the Stanley Cup final. Of course, Roman Josi was a big part of that and the President's Trophy for the next year and has been a big part of all this. But I would say it would be a few more years for that. Now there's two different discussions. There's best player and there's most popular player. You know, obviously you win the Norris, just like Pekka winning the Vezina, that, you know, you win another one of those. Then it gets harder to argue, you know, on the best part, on the most popular part. Ah, boy.
Pekka's going to be hard to beat on that front.
Yeah. That's a tough one for one, you know, because obviously it's like quarterback in football. The goalie in hockey kind of has an edge anyway. And then just what Pekka has been as a guy in this town, again, I'm not knocking Roman at all, because he's been a terrific representative of this franchise and he will be for the next several years. But yeah, I think that's still quite a mountain to climb.
Let's go to our text line driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. Ben texts in and says, Roman has another 6 years to go before I compare those two. Don't fall for recency bias. Well, I don't know how much of it's recency bias. Roman Josi's been on the team since 2012. So this has been a long time coming for Roman Josi. He's already.
Yeah, they've done a lot together.
Yeah.
Right. They've done a lot of these great things together, obviously. So, I mean, it's a worthwhile. I wouldn't have thought of it, but it is an interesting thing to bring up. And again, the best player. I mean, if you are, I mean, look at it this way. Like if Roman Josi is the best defenseman right now in hockey, which, I mean, he just won the Norris. So, I mean, he is, right? You know, if you sustain that, then, I mean, if you compare Pekka to other goalies, you know, he had a good stretch as one of the best, I would say, but relative to position, I think you can make the argument that right now Roman Josi is on probably a shorter list than Pekka was for most of his career. I don't know. Is that fair to say?
I think so.
So yeah, hey, you move forward here again, to me, you win another Norris and then I think you really have a case.
Yeah, and some people will say, you know, the argument right now for Roman is for him and Shea Weber. Like, what's that competition like? If you're identifying the best defenseman in the history of the franchise, which way are you going? And it's easy to say, you know, Josi's got the Norris Trophy and Shea Weber doesn't. I also think Shea Weber got robbed at least once, probably twice, when it comes to the Norris Trophy in that race. So when it comes to that, I think that conversation is close. I think right now Josi's on a good track. Rene still is number one. I think he's got a pretty significant lead at this point. But, you know, Josi signed for the next 8 years. If you get, you know, halfway through this contract and he's still playing at an elite level and still putting up, you know, 50, 55 points a year as a defenseman, and you're playing well defensively and you're leading this team to more success in the playoffs, that conversation, I think, is going to shift in favor of Roman Josi in terms of longevity and just how long he's played at an elite level. Like, it's not like this last year was the first time Roman Josi's been elite. I mean, he's been at an elite level for a few years here now. So he's right in the prime of his career with the way he skates. I don't think he's going anywhere in terms of his production. So I think this is going to continue to get very, very interesting in that conversation over the course of the next year or so.
Yeah, and even though we're talking about individual players, I do think that there's something to this of what the Predators look like in those years. Because some of Pekka Rinne's greatness as a player is also that he brought this franchise to a new place. So in these years with Roman Josi, I think he has a stronger case if he's a great player on at least a good team, you know, versus, you know, one of the few bright spots on a declining team.
Yep, and it's going to be interesting to monitor, and we'll see what sort of a start Roman Josi can get off to this season beginning on Thursday night against Columbus. That's going to do it for us today here on Robbie and Rex Road. We'll be back at 6 a.m. tomorrow. Derek Mason coming up here in a few minutes on Darren Donick and Chase, so make sure that you're tuned in for that. Those guys are coming up. You're listening to ESPN 102.5 The Game.